The Connection Between Faith and Prayer. The seventh talk in a series on prayer was presented by Ron Julian on February 7, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Okay, well, today I'd like to take us into the next phase of our discussion of prayer. The question that is most interesting to me about prayer, the reason that I think about this and try to figure out what it is the Bible's saying about it, at least one of the most interesting questions to me, is what is the connection between prayer and faith? Obviously, faith is something that you got to have. I mean, this is a non-negotiable topic when we look at the Bible. Those with faith are those who enter into eternal life, and those without it do not. What's the connection between being a person of faith and being a person of prayer? That's the question that has sort of driven my studies, the thing that I've tried to understand. And part of the reason is, I mean, I don't have to tell you, you know, in sort of the popular culture, we think we know what the answer to that question is. The connection between prayer and faith is you ask God for something, and if you have faith that you're going to get it, you will. Now, I'd like to say that that's just a misconception in the sort of the popular secular culture about what prayer is about, but unfortunately, that's not always the case. I think that misconception is part of the popular Christian culture as well. I think it is a misconception. That's not the way the Bible connects the concept of prayer and faith. And what I've been trying to do as we talk about prayer through these sessions is to propose a different model for that connection. So let me take a minute here and sort of describe, probably again, this is probably something I've said at various times, but I want to kind of lay out for you again the model that I have in my own mind. What is the connection between faith and prayer? People of faith, it seems to me, are those who know God. People of faith know that God exists, they know that He's there, and they know that He's good. Because of that, then, that faith, that understanding that God is there and that He is good and that I, therefore, should entrust my life to Him, manifests itself in a variety of ways when it comes to prayer. First of all, people of faith are learning to set their hearts on the eternally important things, and their prayers reflect those desires. Now, this is what we've been talking about quite a bit in the times so far that I've been here talking about prayer. When we look at the Lord's Prayer, I've argued that's essentially what that's about. When Jesus says, pray like this, in essence what He's saying is your heart should be set on these things. If you know God, then you should be longing for His kingdom. If you know God, then you should trust Him to provide for your needs in this life. If you know God, then you ought to recognize that you need forgiveness before this holy God and be seeking that from Him. If you know God, you ought to recognize that your big problem in life is that evil could easily come along and seduce and destroy you, and what you need is for God to rescue you. The people who know God and know what life is about have these things on their hearts. Bring in your kingdom, forgive me, rescue me, take care of me. That's the person who knows God. That's how we ought to pray, because that's what our hearts ought to be set on. I've talked about that quite a bit in times past. That's one of the ways in which our faith manifests itself in prayer, in that as my heart is coming to be set on the things that are eternally important, those things are reflected in the way I pray. What I want is changing, and thus the way I talk to God is changing. That's one of the pictures that I see in the Bible. Second, people of faith are confident that God will keep his promises. If they ask him to do things that he has promised to do, then they are confident that he will indeed do what he promised. This is where we get that idea that the Bible says that if you believe that God will do stuff, then you're going to get it. We're right to recognize that the Bible in certain ways is calling us to believe that God is going to do what we ask him to do. But what I would argue is the Bible is saying that when God is on the record, when God has said, this is what I'm going to do, then it would be unbelieving and wrong of me not to have confidence that he will in fact do that. So you can take specific examples in the Bible where particular people have particular promises. The example I always think of is Elijah when he prays that the rain would come. This is not just something that he happened to get in his head. He wasn't sitting around one day thinking, I'm really tired of this drought. I think I would like God to send some rain, so maybe I'll ask him and maybe he'll do it. The fact is, he was a prophet who had been charged with sending a message to Israel that said basically, look, it's not going to rain until Elijah says so. And so when Elijah went to pray, he did it with the confidence. This is what God is all about. He told me that it would not rain until I prayed to him that it would rain. And so he could pray with the confidence. This is going to happen because this is what God said would happen. All the other people in Israel praying to God at that time for the rain to come were just expressing a hope to God. I would really like this to happen, God. This is my request. But when Elijah asked, he had a promise that his request would be heard. And so he could have a confidence and ought to have had a confidence that others couldn't in that situation. Well, the Bible promises many things to God's people. It promises us forgiveness. It promises us wisdom. It promises us ultimate deliverance from sin and death and entrance into eternal life. And when we pray for those sorts of things, we ought to pray with complete confidence that God will indeed do what he said he would do. So there is that, those issues, that when I pray, it is appropriate for me to have that confidence. God is indeed going to do what I ask. Because to have doubt would be to suggest that God doesn't keep his promises. God doesn't do what he said he would do. So that's another way in which faith manifests itself in prayer. Now, both of those first issues tend to revolve around the big things, the things where God himself has come in and made promises and said, these are the important things, these are the things I'm going to do. And so it's appropriate for me to have my heart set on those things and to express it in my prayers. And it is appropriate for me to have confidence that God is going to do what I ask. That's not all that prayer is about, though, and that's not the only way, those are not the only ways in which faith and prayer are connected. People of faith also take their concerns to God, believing that he truly cares for them as he says he does. And what I'm getting at here is there are those prayers that we pray that are not about things that I have promises about. I do not have a promise from God that this particular burden that is troubling me at the moment is going to go away the way I want it to go away. Maybe I'm facing the prospect of death for myself or someone I love. I have no promise that death is going to go away. I can pray for there to be life instead of death, but on the short run, I have no guarantee that that's the way it's going to turn out. But it can be appropriate and right for me to take my concerns to God. When the pressure is on, when I am hurting or someone else is hurting, where do I go? I go to my Creator. I go to the one that I trust, that I know is there, that I know that cares for me. It can be an expression of faith to take those concerns to God, knowing that I have no assurance. I have not been told specifically that the outcome of this is going to be exactly what I want it to be. But going to God in trust and in faith is an appropriate sort of thing. So prayer in that sense can be another kind of expression of faith. And then finally, although, I mean, there are probably other ways as well, but these four come to mind for me. People of faith continue to trust God even when the answer to their immediate specific prayers is no. And so what I'm getting at here is that one of the ways that we express our faith in prayer is that we keep going back to God, we keep trusting Him, even though with those kinds of issues where we have been given no promise, no assurance that things are going to turn out the way we want, and indeed they don't turn out the way we want, we keep going back anyway. We know that God is good. The fact is that He keeps His promises, He is on our side, and the fact that He has decided that it is not in my best interests for things to turn out the way I wanted them to turn out, that doesn't change the fact that He's good and He's the one that I ought to go to. So, the idea, as I understand it, is that faith and prayer are connected in a variety of ways. I have believed that what God has said is good is truly good, and so my prayers express my desires for those things. I believe that God keeps His promises, and so I continue to hold on and trust that He will do what He said He will do. There is no question about it. I believe that God is good, and so anything that is troubling me, I take to Him because He, above all others, is the one who cares for me, who is capable of dealing with my problems, and is the one that I ought to turn to above all others. And faith holds on and continues to trust and believe in God even when the answer to the specific question at hand is no. That's how I would describe the relationship between faith and prayer. So, we can ask that question that often gets asked, does God answer prayer? And it seems to me that there are different ways that we can answer that question depending on what issue we're talking about. First of all, does God always do good for those who believe that He is good and who look to Him? Yes, He does. He hears the prayers of everyone whose heart is a heart of faith. In Romans, with a famous verse that we read, God causes all things to work together for good for those who love God, for those who are called according to His purpose. That's the truth. Those who look to God for life will find it. And so in that sense, the ultimate sense, the cries of God's people to Him are ultimately always heard. And the answer is ultimately yes. But does God answer prayer in the sense that He always gives us what we want when we want it? And the answer to that is sometimes yes and sometimes no. Sometimes He does give us what we want because He loves us. And sometimes He does not give us what we want because He loves us. That's the framework in which I'm understanding the relationship between faith and prayer. Not so simple a one as if you believe it, you get it. Actually, I think it's quite possible that I could believe I'm going to get something and not get it. Now, in the times past here when I've been talking about prayer, we've been concentrating on that aspect of prayer, that the first one that I described, that place where my prayers are coming to reflect a growing understanding of what is really true and valuable and important. In other words, my prayers are becoming more and more like the Lord's Prayer. I want to turn my attention now for a while to those kinds of prayers where we express our desires to God, where we come to Him and say, okay, I know I don't have a promise that things are going to turn out this way, but I am burdened, I really want something, or I'm really suffering in the situation, or whatever it might be, and I pray to God, please do X. I want to talk about that a little bit, and in particular, I want to look at some very famous passages. This is nothing new probably to most of you, but I want to look at some very famous passages in the Bible where God said no. And probably the most famous of those passages, deservedly so, one of the most significant events in the history of the world, I think, if you stop and think about it, just think about all of the unique, amazing, world-shaking events that have happened throughout the history of mankind. I think One of those events is when the Son of God prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. Let's talk about that for a minute. There are a couple of different places in the Gospels where we could find this. I just took a short passage from Luke in chapter 20. I'll just read a couple of verses to you. "And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and he knelt down and began to pray, saying, 'Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done.' Now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground." Obviously, one of the most striking examples of God saying no. I mean, it's an amazing thing if you think about it. Here is the Messiah. Here is the Chosen One. Here is God Himself become incarnate in a man. God writing Himself into the very story of human history, entering into the world at our level, becoming one of us. And here He is praying to the Father, expressing the desires of His heart. And the answer turns out to be, and we'll talk about this in a second, but essentially, we can say in one sense, the answer to His request is no. Now you understand what He's asking here. He knows very well what is in front of Him. As you read through the Gospels, it becomes very clear that Jesus knows what's going to happen. He knows the significance of what's going to happen. He knows that it can't be any other way. He understands that this is the purpose of God, and this is one of the main reasons why he came upon the earth, was to be the propitiation for the sins of the world. He understands all of that as He's going into it. So it's not as if He's in any doubt as about the significance of what's going to happen, or the inevitability, I think, really, of what's going to happen. And yet, in this situation, understanding something of the agony, something of the personal price that He's going to pay to go through this, His request is, could you find a way to let me out? Could you find a way to make it so I don't have to do this? And He's described as being in agony and praying very fervently. This is not a theoretical or hypothetical or abstract idea to Him. He is right on the threshold of a terrible experience, something that is going to affect Him personally in a profound way. He's facing into it, and it is such a disturbing prospect that He's saying to the Father, could you let me out? Could you find a way so that I don't have to do this? First of all, we can see that even this request, expressing His desire in this way, we can see it as an expression of His faith, and I think it's appropriate to do so. If you think about the alternative, I mean, we don't usually think about it this way. We're so used to, you know, I mean, Jesus obviously, He always does it right. So we're just used to the idea that, of course, He's going to do it that way. But in this situation, there's somebody that He could have gone to take care of the situation very easily. He could have gone to the Sanhedrin. He could have said, look, I promise, I'll go to Galilee, I'll be a carpenter, maybe I'll take up fishing, I'll never bother you again. They probably would have gone for it. Hey, this is an easy way of solving this problem. He's agreed to get out of our hair and stop the whole thing. He could have avoided the cross very easily from a human perspective, if you think about it that way. If his goal was, how can I get out of this? There are things he could have done to try to make sure that it didn't happen. But that's not his perspective. He knows that his destiny is in the hands of the Father. There's no one else to go to. Obviously, he was not claiming a promise. In fact, it's fairly clear that he understands that the answer is probably going to be no. And what's most significant, what the striking thing about this passage, the thing that has given believers so much to think about over the centuries. I mean, this is one of those things that you really can't think about enough, I think. You could spend your whole life thinking about this moment, because in spite of the fact that he understood very well the agony of what he was facing, his response was, if you want me to do it, then that's what I want to. You understand that, in a sense, he has this desire. His personal pain that he's going to be facing brings him to that spot where he says, I don't want to do this. Unless you want me to do this, in which case, that's what I want to. That's essentially what he's saying when he says, not my will, but yours be done. You know, I have this perspective right now in my own... Now, you understand, when I talk about the limited perspective of Jesus, I'm talking about, we need to take seriously the fact that he was a human being. This was a particular human being who was facing an agonizing death. And from that perspective, the pressure of that, his personal desire was, I don't want to do this. But he took that personal desire and said, I know that you know better. The pressure of this situation is saying to me, I want out. But your purposes are the ones that count. Your purposes are the ones that I want to prevail. And so this is one of those classic situations where we have God saying no to a prayer, but it's the most striking example that you could think of, because certainly it's not because there's anything wrong with the one who's praying. It's not that he doesn't have enough faith. It's not that he's not worthy of God's care and blessing. Of all human beings who have ever lived, this is the one who ought to get what he wants on the basis of his worthiness before God. And yet the answer is no. Now, in a sense, the answer was no. And this is part of what we need to understand. Jesus went through all of that agony that he anticipated. There isn't any of it that he dodged. Everything he was anticipating happened. And yet, we understand that Jesus put his life into the hands of the Father, expecting good things. When he said, not my will, but yours be done, it wasn't out of some sort of sense of despair and just resolving himself to the inevitable. He wasn't just saying, I know you're a sadist, and what can I do about it, so I guess you're going to beat me up. His expectation was that God's great, glorious, and perfect purposes were going to be accomplished. Hebrews has a very interesting thing. I've talked about this before, but I think it's very interesting. It says, in the days of his flesh, talking about Jesus, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his piety. Well, the striking thing about that is, in a sense, of course, he wasn't heard, because what he asked for was, take this cup away from me, and he didn't. He had to drink the whole thing. And yet, in another sense, I think the author of Hebrews understands that Jesus is putting himself in the hands of the Father, and although he had to go through a very difficult ordeal, and he was not spared that ordeal, in the end, the outcome was life. He didn't stay in the grave, but he was raised. Not that he escaped the suffering of the cross, but that he triumphed over it. And I think that ought to be the model that we have for ourselves with the prayers of desire, with those prayers that we call out to God, save me, rescue me from this difficulty, give me comfort, take away the pain. The answer may be, no, not yet, not that way, not now. But the answer ultimately is not no, if I have put my faith in God. The answer ultimately is, I hear you, I know what your problem is, and I have committed myself to solving it. That's the tension in these kinds of situations. What we don't want to do is make it simplistic and say, if God loved me, then he would do what I asked him to do, the way I asked him to do it. If we get that in mind, we have not understood the biblical picture of how prayer works, and we don't really understand God. We don't understand his love. We don't understand his wisdom. But even as he's saying no, It's because ultimately he has a bigger yes that he's preparing. That is ultimately the biblical picture of how my desires interact with the purposes of God. And so the prayer that Jesus prayed in Gethsemane was a prayer of faith. He had faith in that instead of turning to the authorities or the people that supposedly had his fate in their hands, he went to God because he knew that the Father was the one who really held his destiny in his hands. He didn't have faith in the sense that he knew he was going to get the specific thing he was praying for. He didn't know that. He didn't believe that. And in fact, as it turned out, he did not get the specific thing he was praying for. But he had confidence. He entrusted himself to the goodness of God, believing that even if he did have to face the thing that he did not want to face, that in the end, good things would come. The best things would come. Okay. Now, I'll turn our attention to another famous passage where God said no. We read about this in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. And I'll read that to you. We're in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Paul has been talking about a man who had these profound revelations taken up into the heavens and shown things that no one had seen before. And it becomes clear as he's talking that this man that he's talking about is in fact himself. So in verse 7 he says, "And because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I entreated the Lord three times that it might depart from me. And he has said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for power is perfected in weakness.' Most gladly, therefore, I will rather boast about my weaknesses, that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weaknesses, with insults, with distresses, with persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." Very striking passage, I think. Here, once again, is a prayer expressing a very strong desire. Paul has some weakness that he calls a thorn in the flesh, which we don't know what it is, but he calls it a thorn in the flesh. I think we can feel fairly confident it is not literally a thorn in the flesh. He's speaking metaphorically, whatever it is he's talking about. And naturally enough, I mean, this is, whatever it is something that is so debilitating that it's like a big thorn in the flesh. It's something that is, in one way or another, cutting into his experience as a human being. Life is more difficult because of this thing. And he wants it removed. Who wouldn't? All of us would want such a thing removed. Now, what is it that he is praying about? I don't know. We have at times, some of you may recall discussions we've had around here. I know that I would find it greatly comforting if it turned out that Paul's thorn in the flesh was not just a physical infirmity, but actually a moral weakness. Now, why would we suggest that such a thing is true? Jack has proposed this as a possibility because of the phrase, "this thorn in the flesh is a messenger of Satan." The question being, what is that phrase doing there? What does he mean that it's a messenger of Satan? If it's some sort of messenger in Paul's life bringing a message from Satan, then what's the message? And Jack has pointed out that Satan is described as the accuser of the brethren. And in fact, one of his names essentially means that, the accuser. And so what would be more debilitating than some sort of a weakness, some moral you couldn't get a hold of, that was a constant messenger from Satan, essentially calling into question, "Oh, sure, you know, you're the great apostle to the Gentiles, huh? Someone like you? That would make sense. That would certainly explain the phrase messenger of Satan. I have to admit, being a person who has wrestled with moral weaknesses of my own, I find it attractive to think that Paul had wrestled the same way. Actually, though, I suppose, you know, on my meter of probability, I think I'm kind of leaning over still in the direction that it's a physical infirmity that he's talking about. And of course, what most people have suggested it is that it's his eyesight. We know that his eyes were not good. At least we strongly suspect that they weren't. You'll recall that in some of his letters, he always dictated his letters to someone else, and occasionally at the end he would sign it himself. And in one of the letters it says, "See with what large letters I am writing my name." And if you ask the question, why was he writing with such large letters, one of the reasons might be that he can't see very well and he has to write really big. I don't know. We don't really know. For our purposes, it's enough to know that this is something, obviously, that he cared about personally. He was not indifferent to this. This was a problem in his life, whatever it was, and he wanted it gone. I would say that it is a reflection of his belief that God is there and that God is good. He goes to him because this is causing great difficulty in his life. And I'm sure he went with the expectation, God, I know that you love me, you've promised to take care of me, and here's this problem, and I'm asking you to take care of it. I don't know, we don't have exactly the evidence of how Paul thought when he started to pray this. We know how he responded in the end when he got the answer. I assume that he did not have that confident expectation that God is going to do this. He certainly understood that he had not been promised that all his troubles in this life would go away. And in any case, that's how it turns out. Once again, we have an example of a person who is clearly one in God's favor, someone who is being used by God in a powerful way, and the answer to his personal request, "I'm suffering, God, please take this away," and the answer is no. It's fairly unusual the way it turns out here, because here we have a very direct response from God. The answer is no. And what's even more unusual is that he is told why. Very often in our own journey through life, we may only have at best a vague sort of understanding of what God's purposes are and why he would say no at a certain spot. Here, Paul has the advantage of being told specifically, "This is why I'm not going to do what you asked me to do." God tells Paul that he intends to use him in a particular way. Paul is going to be an example, perhaps to himself, certainly to the world around him. Even though Paul is, in a sense, crippled by some sort of weakness, the power of God is going to work through him anyway. Now, it's very important, we can see, when we read through Paul's letters, he understands that it's very important that people understand his ministry in a certain light. This is not just some guy who came along and is kind of peddling this wacky idea that he got and trying to convince everybody to come along with him. He claims that his ministry is a work of God, that what he knows through revelation from God, and the message that he is bringing and the power of that message is not because he's a persuasive speaker or because he's a really sharp thinker and he thought it out and this makes a lot of sense, but because this is the message from God and the power of God is behind this message. People should be saying, "I can't figure out how a schmuck like Paul has had such an impact on the world." Because when you ask that question, then you go on to start looking for the answer, and the answer ultimately is that it wasn't Paul. Paul's weaknesses just made it all the more remarkable that his message caught fire and his ministry changed the world. That's what I understand Paul to be recounting as God's answer here. Essentially, I want you and everyone around you to understand that the power of what's going on in this situation is not because you are a person who lacks problems. You are not a person who lacks problems. Nonetheless, my power is going to prevail, and people are going to understand that. You're going to understand it, that I'm the one doing this. The more it's clear to you that it's not you, you're not the one doing this. And of course, what finally becomes clear to us is that Paul understood this answer, and he accepts it. His response is essentially, I accept God's answer. I am content to be weak so that the power of Christ may shine in my life. So, here again, I would argue this is a prayer of faith. He turns to God with his problem because he believes God is there and that God is good. He did not necessarily have the confidence that the answer would be yes. He knew that God had not promised to deliver him on the short term from this thorn in the flesh, and in fact, that's how it turns out. God does not. But he accepts the answer no as being in keeping with God's goodness. God had a reason for saying no, and Paul accepted it. So once again, faith is working in the midst of prayer, but not in that necessarily in that simple, I believe I'm going to get it, and I get it sort of approach. It is that I know God, and so he's the one I'm talking to, and I continue to know him even when it doesn't turn out the way I wanted it to. There's another sort of interesting example of a prayer. In this case, you'll see. In Romans chapter 1, verse 8, we hear Paul talking about a prayer that he is constantly praying. He says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, because your faith is being proclaimed throughout the whole world. For God, whom I serve in my spirit in the preaching of the gospel of his Son, is my witness as to how unceasingly I make mention of you, always in my prayers making request, if perhaps now at last, by the will of God, I may succeed in coming to you. Now, here's another prayer of desire. Paul the Apostle has never been to Rome. He did not found the church in Rome. He knows a few people there, but essentially he's at a distance hearing about how this church has grown up and the problems that the church is encountering, and he would really like to go there, see them face to face, talk to them, teach them, encourage them in the gospel. This is what he wants. He tells them about how he's always praying that he may come. He does that to show them the evidence of what his heart is set on. And you understand, he's telling them, look, you want to know how much I care about you and want to come and be of encouragement to you? I'm always asking God, couldn't I get to Rome? Isn't there a way that I could end up going to Rome and encouraging the brethren there? And so he tells them, I'm always praying that. Clearly, he has no expectation that the answer must be yes. So far, obviously, the answer has been no. And you can see the sort of tentative nature of his language. It really comes across in the Greek. It's sort of, perhaps, now, finally, I could get there. I mean, it's that I've been asking, I've wanted to come, it's been a long time, I keep hearing about what's going on there, and yet I have not been able to come, and I don't know whether I am going to be able to come, but I really hope I'm going to be able to come, so maybe, perhaps, finally, at last, perhaps, yes, could I go? Now, this is not exactly an example of when God says no. This is an interesting example. God said no for quite a while, obviously. Paul was saying, you know, I really want to go there. Ultimately, God's answer was yes, but it's one of those deals where his answer yes was probably more difficult to take than the answer no. Because, of course, how Paul ended up going to Rome was he went to Jerusalem planning to stop there and then go on a trip, and he was hoping to eventually make it to Rome. Instead, his Jewish opponents in Jerusalem trumped up a fake charge and had him arrested. They plotted to take his life, which he narrowly avoided. He stayed in prison for some time on the coast in Caesarea. And then, in order to escape the plot on his life, he appeals to Caesar and thus is taken to Rome by Roman guards. On the way, he's shipwrecked. And finally, he ends up in Rome, and the last we see of him in Acts is he spends 2 years under house arrest there. So God's answer to the question was, yes, Paul, I'll take you to Rome. You don't even have to pay for it. But, in a sense, I guess. But, I mean, you can see, this is all a part of what we need to understand about the way God deals with us. This is the God who accomplishes his purposes, who teaches us things sometimes that we don't want to learn, that brings about good things in ways that we did not anticipate. In fact, if you look at what happened to Paul, it ended up ensuring that he would have the opportunity to talk to governors and kings and emperors. I mean, he had opportunities to proclaim the gospel, some of them we see in Acts, that never would have come about if he had not been arrested. Nonetheless, I'm sure that if you had asked him, that's not the way he would have chosen to go to Rome. His prayer to go to Rome was a prayer of faith. He had this desire to go to Rome. It reflected very well on the desires of his heart. He wanted to go to Rome because he cared about the gospel and he cared about the people in Rome. He wanted to help them, strengthen them in their understanding of the gospel. He went to God, expressed that desire to him. He did not presume that the answer would be yes, because he had no such promise that the answer would be yes. And when the answer turned out to be yes, but this is going to be really tough, he faithfully continued to trust God through every twist and turn. Yeah, I will. Let me point you to one other, what I think is interesting passage, and then I'll open it up for questions. Just real briefly, I think it's interesting what you see later on in Romans in chapter 10, I think it is. I have it? Yes. Now, you have to understand in Romans 9 through 11, Paul is laying out the purposes of God, how God has hardened the hearts of Israel, and how the Gentiles are responding to the gospel in a way that the Jews are not. And if I understand what he's saying in this passage, ultimately he's arguing that someday that's going to turn around and there is going to be that time when God is going to open the eyes of his chosen people, the Jews, and they will turn to him in faith and trust and understand who he is and what he has done and who Jesus is. Okay, so in the midst of this great picture that Paul is painting, where he describes the wisdom and the purposes of God, God has this amazing thing that he's doing throughout history. In the midst of that, at the beginning of chapter 10, he says, "Brethren, my heart's desire and my prayer to God for them is for their salvation." And he's talking about the Jews. And the thing that's striking to me, has always been striking to me about that prayer, is you can see this is an expression of Paul's heart. He is a Jew, and he's living in a world where most of the Jews around him have rejected the message of the Messiah. Paul has met the Messiah. Paul has been taken up into the heavens and had the purposes of God revealed to him. Paul knows this is what the prophets have been promising for centuries and centuries. This is what human history is all about. And most of my people have looked it right in the face and said, no thanks. Personally, that was a very difficult thing for Paul. And what he's saying is, my heart's desire and prayer to God is for their salvation. And he has the language that he uses. I lost it. That may be in another spot. I lost it. It's that spot where he talks about essentially, if it would accomplish anything, I wish they could be saved. I could give them my salvation, essentially. Now, Paul is expressing his desire to God in prayer. This is what I want. But on the other hand, look at what Paul knows. He understands that God has a purpose that he is working out in history, and that in fact, now is not the time when the Jewish people are going to turn as one toward God in faith. God has revealed, has laid it out. There is a cycle to these things. This works in a certain way. This is the time of the Gentiles. And yet there is that time coming when God is going to return and finish his purposes with the Jews. That's what Paul knows. He even knows it so well, he even goes into this great statement of praise of God's wisdom and inscrutable ways. I mean, you know, his judgments are so deep and wise, what he has decided to do in human history. It's an amazing and wonderful thing. And yet, Paul's personal desires are that the Jews would come to recognize the truth and be saved. He knows that ultimately that's going to happen, but he also knows that many of those around him, it's just not going to happen. That's not the way it's going to go down. And so, here again is an example of his trust in God. He takes his prayers to God. This is my desire. And what he understands is that ultimately, my desire is going to be fulfilled. I know that God's ultimate purpose is to bring everything together, to make everything right, and to fulfill his promises to the Jewish people. But he also knows, in his day-to-day experience, he's going to encounter an awful lot of Jewish people who think he is a crackpot. Paul, the one who has talked to the risen Christ and been into the third heaven and understands better than any other human being what it is that God is doing and the importance of what Jesus has done, his people are going to look at him and say, "You're crazy. What have you been smoking? That doesn't make any sense." I mean, just listen to the Pharisees. You can tell that your gospel doesn't have anything to do with the law and the Old Testament. That just doesn't make any sense. So here again, Paul's desire is expressed in his prayers, even as he knows that it's not really going to work out the way he would like it to immediately. Ultimately, his confidence is that God is doing right, and this is going to work out the way it ought to. Okay, so it seems to me that if we are people of faith, God always answers our prayers. To any believing heart crying out to God for deliverance, the answer is always yes. But the answer is not, "Yes, I will do what you want right now." The answer is, "Yes, my hand is on your life, and no one or no thing can stop me from blessing you. I will keep my promises today and tomorrow and lead you into true life where you will have the desires of your heart." If we have that picture, I think it can keep us from making a lot of foolish and ultimately painful mistakes in our relationship with God as we think about who he is and what he's going to do. Well, we have a few minutes if anybody wants to ask a question or point out the error of my ways, or
the example of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane is very helpful to me, and I kind of wanted to check out, kind of share how it's helpful, and check out if that's I should be receiving comfort. Oftentimes, I and other people have shared this experience with me too. In the Christian community, when we're struggling, the counsel received is kind of like, I don't know if how many of you have seen the movie The King and I, where the mom is telling the boy how to deal with his fear. In the words of the song, I'm not going to sing to relax, but whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle happy tunes so no one will suspect that I'm afraid. Right. And the result of this deception is when I fool the people I fear, I fool myself as well.
Right.
And that's often the kind of counsel in spiritual terms. You know, there's a lot of godly type words attached to it, but that I've been given. Basically, work yourself up to a state of experiencing feeling not afraid, feeling faith, feeling whatever. And that seems to me to be the very opposite of life, and I've really experienced it as death in my life when I have committed myself to that kind of thing. And what I see Jesus doing is being very present with what was in him and taking that to God. And it was out of the context of that that his "not my will but thine be done" was full. It would have been a hollow thing if it was prayed in denial of his whole experience. The reason I want to just double check as far as the comfort that I receive from that is my experience is not like Jesus's, in that because I'm a sinner, I experience extra terror, extra pain, rebellion, lots of things. As I bring what's in me, I bring a lot of things Jesus didn't bring to that situation. But it seems that the best I can do is bring what's in me, all of those things, and struggle, not denying any of that, and that out of that becomes comes a much more solid ground of accepting and being able to cry out, "Yes, I really do want."
No, that makes sense to me. Let me say back a couple of things and see if we're on the same wavelength here. It seems to me there's a couple of ideas here. First of all, I think you're right. We're not going to get anywhere trying to take the approach that somehow, which I think the church sometimes kind of pushes us toward, we're supposed to be victorious here. If I was a person of faith, I wouldn't feel this way. This kind of the message I get, and so somehow I've got to stuff it. I've got to somehow get out here and convince everybody and myself that I'm feeling something that I'm not. I think that approach is doomed to failure, and you're just gonna. I mean, you know, sooner or later, reality is going to break in. I mean, you just can't fight off reality, I don't think. So I agree with that. And I also agree, I think it's important for us to understand that there are inappropriate feelings that we can have, inappropriate in the sense that they are not in line with reality. There are terrors that I face because I have really not... I have not yet understood that God is on my side. And if I understood that, there are certain aspects to my emotional life that would not be the way they are. And to those things, I don't get over them by denying them or stuffing them, but I have to interact with them. I have to face into it and say, well, so what's the truth here? And there are things to say back. So when Jesus says, "Don't be anxious," there's a picture of there's a kind of an emotional life that is inappropriate because it's based on looking at life in the wrong way. But the Jesus who said, "Don't be anxious," is also the one who is agonizing in the garden, sweating drops of like blood and crying out to God fervently, "I don't want to do this." So, and I would argue this is not sin in him. There's nothing wrong in what he did here. So it's helpful to us to recognize that there are painful emotional reactions that are not inappropriate. That there are things in life that put pressures on us that it would be sort of perverse not to have a certain kind of emotional reaction to it. Maybe you haven't understood yet. I mean, this is serious. Something big is happening here, and if I understand that, then there are certain emotional reactions that are appropriate. So there are both of those aspects. Yes, I think it's right for us to recognize that it's not appropriate to try to stuff what we're feeling, some of our feelings need to be spoken to. Some of them need to be addressed, and we need to come to understand the reality in such a way that as that understanding takes hold, our emotions will subside. Some of our emotions are just right and appropriate. This is a life of suffering, and Jesus suffered, and we will suffer because there's sin in it and there's death in it, and the appropriate response to sin and death is to grieve and to suffer. I mean, that's the way it is. So, yeah, I think everything that I'm hearing you say sounds right to me.
Just one more time.
Right.
When he says, don't be anxious, he's speaking to an anxiety that is based on wrong understanding, sinfulness, whatever, and that he could have put all sorts of different words in there as far as don't have this experience because that's based on a...
Right.
You're saying, and or I just want to check this mm-hmm. out, I would hope you're saying that I'm not supposed to go, okay, and do this stuffing thing. I'm supposed to go ahead and be honest with how anxious I am and be struggling towards trying to seek after a right understanding that would in turn change that anxiousness. I'm not
right.
supposed to like just kind of commit
right.
an emotional...
Right, because in Jesus' teaching and another teaching in the Bible, the grounds for my lack of anxiety is not... He doesn't say, I told you not to be anxious, so cut it out. He says, don't be anxious because this is the truth. And so what we're supposed to do is, that our, I think our feelings ultimately follow in the wake of what we have decided is true. So what he's asking us to do is come to terms with that. You believe that's true? Do you think that God is as much on your side as I'm saying he is? You know, is your destiny as secure as I'm saying it is?
Mm-hmm.
Is God to be trusted? Is it the case that there is nothing in your life that can ultimately get at your welfare and well-being because God has you in the palm of his hand? Do you know that's true? When you come to understand that's true, then the emotional realities of your life start to change. And because we're sinners, we wrestle with that, and there are times when we lose sight of that, and the emotions kind of go along with it. But
and it's valuable to learn, oh, I don't trust that as much as I thought.
Right.
Oh, this is showing me that I don't understand
right.
these things as much as
right.
I thought.
Right, that's a good point. I mean, I think in a lot of ways our emotions are kind of the analogous to our pain receptors in our skin. You know, that I'm in pain, something's wrong. Now, what we tend to do is, I'm in pain, something's wrong, the solution is make the thing go away that's making me uncomfortable. And then that's where we just don't understand. But the fact that it indicates that something's wrong, that's true enough. Usually, it's more, you know, what's going on in here.